New Year, same extra value meals at McDonald's. So now get two snack wraps plus fries and a medium soft drink for just $8.
For a limited time only, prices and participation may vary. Prices may be higher in Hawaii, Alaska, and California and for delivery.
Hello, and welcome back to another episode of Crime with Holly. I'm your host, Holly, and as always, I am so glad to be spending a little bit of time with you guys today. Happy freaking New Year, you guys. 2026 is upon us, and I could not be more ready to embrace the new year. I'm hoping and praying that 2026 is the year for change. My biggest thing I am hoping that will happen in 2026 is I'm hoping that the Air Force will finally decide that it's time to move my family out of Nevada. Las Vegas has been so fun, but let me just say, desert life is not for me. So let's keep our fingers crossed that the military orders are in the works, preferably to a really good place. In today's episode, we are diving into a murder that took place around Christmas. This episode was supposed to come out the week of Christmas, but my youngest son got sick with the nastiness and was down and out all week. He was barely able to celebrate the holiday, which was so sad. I was unable to record due to obviously taking care of him, but honestly, it was a good little break where I got to focus on my family, and I hope that you all were able to slow down and enjoy time spent with your loved ones. Whether you celebrate Christmas or not, I do hope that you were able to get some time to relax. I don't have any kind of case updates or anything like that for you guys, but I do have a couple things I need to say, including a Patreon shout out. This week, I had Molly join the Patreon family, and by golly, Miss Molly, you sure made the final days of 2025 fantastic. Also, not gonna lie, I've been dying to say that golly saying for like ever because growing up being a Holly, people said that to me all the time. So my apologies, because I'm going to guess that being a Molly, you likely heard that a bajillion times too. Molly dropped those pesky ads and signed up for the Patreon family for just $2 a month. If you guys want to be like Molly and join the family and not have to deal with ads, you can visit the link in the description of this episode or go to www.patreon.com/crimewithholly to join. Speaking of ads, just a quick note on that topic. Many podcaster friends of mine have recently been made aware that some automatically placed ads may not always align with our content or our values. I want to be completely transparent here and let everyone know that I have zero control over the automatic ads that are inserted into episodes. If an ad plays that feels offensive, political, or otherwise unfavorable, please know that it was not selected or approved by me. Some of my fellow podcast friends have received many negative reviews due to unfavorable ads, and it's truly unfortunate because we have zero control. Unless I am reading the ad myself, that means I approved it. But if it's not read by me and it's just some random ad, know that I did not approve it. It's just what they placed. Okay, so with that little tidbit out of the way, let's get into the details of today's case. Today's episode is on the murder of Lisa Solomon. In December of 1987 on Long Island, Christmas felt familiar and full. Store windows glowed with oversized lights, malls were bustling with last-minute shoppers, and cassette tapes of holiday music played in cars crawling through the winter traffic. Families mailed handwritten cards and gathered around the television at night for Christmas specials that everyone used to watch. Shows like Charlie Brown Christmas, Rudolph, Frosty, and Santa Claus is Coming to Town. The movie A Christmas Story had just been released a few years prior and was becoming a major staple in homes across the country. For many, Christmas is a time built around togetherness. It's when families gather, traditions are honored, and routines feel comforting and familiar. Homes fill with decorations, kitchens stay busy, and schedules revolve around shopping trips, holiday music, and making sure everything feels just right. There's always a sense of anticipation in the air that even as an adult today, I still feel it. It's the slowing down, reconnecting, and creating memories meant to last long after the season ends. For Lisa Solomon, this Christmas felt like a milestone, one she believed she would remember forever. It was the first Christmas that she would celebrate alongside her new husband, Matthew Solomon, as they began building a life together. Not only were Lisa and Matthew preparing to celebrate Christmas, they were also approaching a milestone of their own, 2 months of marriage. Lisa and Matthew Solomon were married on October 25th, 1987, in an intimate ceremony attended by just about 40 people. Surrounded by their closest friends and family, it was a quiet, meaningful celebration. Exactly the kind of wedding that reflected how close-knit their world felt at the time. But their story began years earlier. Lisa and Matthew first met when Lisa was 18 years old and Matthew was 19. At the time, Matthew was working at a local gas station and Lisa would often walk by. One day, after seeing her walk by so many times, he finally worked up the nerve to whistle at her, and then he chased her down, striking up a conversation. Matthew was charming, handsome, confident, and Lisa herself was stunning. She had big, beautiful brown eyes framed by long lashes, and she had that iconic, big, curly 1980s hair. Hair that her mother, Diane, later said Lisa spent hours perfecting each morning. Diane recalled that her daughter never left the house without being completely ready for the day. You wouldn't catch Lisa without her makeup done and her hair styled just right. From the moment Lisa and Matthew met, sparks flew. Lisa was no stranger to attention, though. She had been a popular high school cheerleader, athletic, vibrant, and naturally magnetic. Men noticed her everywhere she went. But for reasons only she could explain, Matthew really stood out to her. He had whatever it was that caught her attention and held it. Once they started dating, they were inseparable, deeply connected, and completely head over heels in love. Matthew worked hard to make a good impression, not just with Lisa, but with her family as well. Diane remembered him as polite, funny, and full of charisma. He went out of his way to make Lisa happy, showering her with gifts and affection. At the same time, Lisa's family was going through an incredibly difficult period. Her father was seriously ill, hospitalized full-time as his health declined from cancer. Matthew stepped in wherever he could, helping Diane around the house. He would mow the lawn in the spring and summer, he would rake leaves in the fall, and shoveled snow in the winter. If Diane found a stray bug in the house, she'd call Matthew and he would come over immediately to help her take care of it. Diane adored him. She fully approved of this relationship. Matthew even began calling her mom pretty early on into the relationship. By December of 1985, Lisa was working as a loan processor at a local bank, and Matthew had moved into a steady job as a sheet metal worker, earning a solid paycheck. The couple had been together for 2 years when on Christmas Eve, Matthew got down on one knee and asked Lisa to marry him. He presented her with a beautiful engagement ring, one that reportedly cost $5,000. And in 1985, that was a significant amount of money. I mean, if you ask me, it still is a significant amount of money today. But back then, that was crazy. Now, while they were dating, they did have their moments where things weren't all butterflies and roses, like most relationships, I would say. Diane said that there were times where Matthew would seem possessive over Lisa, and before they got married, the couple would break up and then find that they just couldn't live without each other and they would get back together again. And honestly, this wasn't anything too crazy. Sounds like your typical teenage on-again, off-again relationship. On October 25th, 1987, when they got married, Lisa looked radiant. And I will make sure to post pictures of their wedding day because she was so beautiful. She truly was such a beautiful bride in her puffy sleeve wedding dress that was very on trend for the 80s. After their honeymoon in Hawaii, Lisa and Matthew returned to Long Island and began settling into married life. They moved into a small upstairs apartment inside a home in Huntington Station, and it was an exciting time because for the first time ever, Lisa and Matthew were living together. On Christmas Eve 1987, Lisa went into work like any other day. While she was there, she spoke with her mom on the phone several times, checking in, chatting, and sharing her excitement for the night ahead. She was looking forward to getting off work and heading home to celebrate with Matthew. They were not only going to celebrate Christmas, but also that 2 months of marriage. They had made simple, intimate plans for the evening. They were going to exchange gifts, sit down to a lobster dinner at home, and share some champagne in their small apartment. Later that night, Lisa planned to take her mom to midnight mass, and she told Diane that she would pick her up at 11 p.m. So after work, Lisa goes home, she begins her evening with her husband, and after they consumed 3 bottles of champagne and they ate their lobster dinner, they made love. Lisa popped in her recorded video of the latest episode of All My Children, which, if you're not familiar with what All My Children was, it was an ABC soap opera that started in early 1970 and ran until 2011, with a brief revival of the show in 2013. In total, the show had 22 seasons. My mom lived for this dang show, and I personally don't really remember anything about it, but I will tell you that when my mom was watching it, we all had to be quiet because she was so engrossed with whatever was going on. And apparently, Lisa was the same. She loved this show and made sure to record it on her VCR so she never missed an episode. According to Matthew, later that night on Christmas Eve, Lisa settled in to watch the latest episode that she had recorded, and at some point, Matthew said he fell asleep. He claimed that's when everything changed. Matthew said Lisa became angry. She was upset that he had fallen asleep on Christmas Eve instead of spending time with her. What started as frustration quickly turned into an argument, one that continued to escalate until Lisa, according to Matthew, stormed out of the apartment and into the night. Matthew would later say this behavior of storming out of the house and going for a walk wasn't unusual for Lisa. When Lisa got upset, he claimed that she would sometimes just go for a walk to cool off and blow off steam, and then she would return home. But this time, it was different. Lisa left the apartment without a jacket, without her purse, without her keys, and without her asthma medication, something that she never went anywhere without. And it's important to remember, this was Christmas Eve night on Long Island. It was cold. It was dark, and snow was either already on the ground or expected overnight. In Matthew's mind, Lisa was just going for a quick walk, maybe up and down the block, and then she would be back shortly. She had to come back. She didn't have her belongings. She wasn't dressed for the weather, but time passed, and Lisa didn't return. Matthew said he eventually went out looking for her, getting into his car and driving around for hours, checking streets and nearby areas, growing increasingly worried that something might have happened, that maybe Lisa had crossed paths with someone who meant her harm. Then, around 5:30 in the morning, Matthew came across a police officer responding to a house fire. He approached them, showed them a photo of Lisa, and asked if she was somehow involved in this fire. They told him that she was not, and Matthew explained that his wife was missing and that they had an argument, and then she went out for a walk and she hadn't come home. Because the officers were already handling another emergency, they told Matthew that they would keep an eye out for her, and Matthew continued his search.
Forget the pressure to overhaul your life. The new year doesn't need a new you. It needs you. Grounded, supported, and ready to grow. Grow Therapy helps you make meaningful change at your pace and on your time. Whether it's your first time in therapy or your 50th, Grow makes it easier to find a therapist who fits you, not the other way around. They connect you with thousands of independent, licensed therapists across the U.S., offering both virtual and in-person sessions, nights, and weekends. You can search by what matters, like insurance, specialty, identity, or availability, to get started in as little as 2 days. And if something comes up, you can cancel up to 24 hours in advance at no cost. There are no subscriptions and no long-term commitments. You just pay per session. Grow helps you find therapy on your time. Whatever challenges you're facing, Grow Therapy is here to help. Grow accepts over 100 insurance plans, including Medicaid, in some states. Sessions average about $21 with insurance, and some pay as little as $0, depending on their plan. Visit growtherapy.com/get started today to get started. That's growtherapy.com/get started. growtherapy.com/get started. Availability and coverage vary by state and insurance plan.
New Year, same extra value meals at McDonald's. So now get 2 snack wraps plus fries and a medium soft drink for just $8.
For limited time only, prices and participation may vary. Prices may be higher in Hawaii, Alaska, and California and for delivery.
By sunrise on December 25th, 1987, with still no sign of Lisa Solomon, her husband Matthew Solomon made the decision to contact her family. At 6 a.m., Diane was jolted awake by the sound of the phone ringing. She was disoriented, confused, and then she realized that she was still in her church clothes. The night before, Diane had showered and gotten ready for midnight mass. With time to spare, she decided to lie down and rest until Lisa arrived to wake her so they could leave together. But Lisa never came. So when the phone rang at 6 a.m. on Christmas morning, the reality hit her all at once. When Diane answered, she was stunned to hear Matthew on the other end of the line, panicked, frantic, and yelling. He was shouting that Lisa was missing, that she never came home. Now, Diane, being just woken up, she struggled to process what she was even hearing. His words weren't registering with her. When she asked him to explain again, Matthew told her that Lisa had gone out for a walk to be alone and never returned. Once Diane understood what he was saying, she rushed to Lisa and Matthew's apartment, and together they called the police. When officers arrived, Matthew told them his version of the night. He said the two had enjoyed a nice dinner, drank 3 bottles of champagne, and made love. Later, Lisa settled in to watch a show she had recorded while he fell asleep. Matthew said he woke up to Lisa angry that he had fallen asleep on Christmas Eve. According to him, she stormed out of the apartment to clear her head, leaving behind her jacket, purse, keys, and all of her other belongings. Matthew told police that he assumed that Lisa would return within about 20 minutes, so he went back to sleep. He claimed that he slept for roughly 3 hours, and then when he woke up and she still wasn't home, he began driving around looking for her. After searching for hours, he finally called Diane at 6 a.m. After taking his statement, officers told them to wait 24 hours, that if Lisa didn't return home, they would then take further action. But when police left, Diane and Matthew both knew that they couldn't wait. This behavior was completely unlike Lisa. She would never not come home. And they were deeply concerned about one thing in particular. Lisa had left without her asthma medication, something that she had to take twice a day, and she depended on that medication to function. They immediately began organizing a search. Friends and family flooded the apartment, cousins, aunts, uncles, all desperate to help. As word spread through the community, complete strangers put their Christmas celebrations on hold and joined the search. Flyers were printed and posted, maps were laid out, and Matthew began assigning people to search in specific areas. Those searching on foot carried CB radios, calling back to the makeshift headquarters to report what they found. And then the media picked up the story. Less than 24 hours, Lisa's face was broadcasted across the news. A young newlywed missing on Christmas Day. It was a story that captured everyone's attention, and Matthew Solomon made sure he was front and center on the news, begging for Lisa's safe return. By Christmas night, Lisa had officially been missing for 24 hours, and police formally stepped in. They went to the home of Lisa's mother, Diane. Investigators began by asking her to walk them through the events leading up to Lisa's disappearance. Diane explained that she and Lisa had planned to attend Christmas Mass together. Lisa and Matthew practiced different faiths and celebrated Christmas differently, but they still intended to spend the holiday together, with Lisa joining her mother later that night for Mass. Diane was understandably distraught, but she remained hopeful. She described her daughter as independent, vivacious, and incredibly strong, someone who could take care of herself if she needed to. After speaking with Diane, investigators asked Matthew to meet them at the precinct. There, he was cooperative and repeated the same account he had already given police. When asked about his marriage, Matthew spoke in length about how happy they were. They were newlyweds, still riding the high of their wedding and honeymoon, deeply in love. He had nothing but positive things to say about Lisa and their relationship. Matthew appeared devastated, almost in disbelief that any of this was even happening. While speaking with investigators, Matthew brought up a man named Rob. According to him, Rob had come into Lisa's bank a few months earlier seeking a loan to purchase a Corvette. While Lisa was helping him, Matthew claimed that Rob flirted with her and repeatedly asked her out. Lisa, he said, always declined politely and told him that she was engaged. Matthew said Rob was a regular at the bank and seemed to take a strong interest in Lisa. But when investigators pressed for more information, Matthew didn't have much else to offer. So detectives went directly to Lisa's workplace, the Anchor Bank in Huntington Station. There, they spoke with Lisa's supervisors and coworkers, all of whom had wonderful things to say about her. They confirmed that Lisa had worked on Christmas Eve and that the bank closed early that day around 2 p.m., after closing, the staff stayed behind for a small holiday celebration. And it was during that gathering that Lisa talked excitedly about the romantic evening that she had planned at home with Matthew. Her coworkers described her as clearly happy, deeply in love, fully embracing her new life as a wife. When investigators asked about Rob, everyone knew exactly who they meant. They explained that Rob was indeed a client, a wealthy man who came in for an auto loan. But what stood out was that he actually didn't need that loan. He could have paid for the car outright. Instead, he chose to go through the loan process so he could spend time talking to Lisa. Yet despite everyone knowing about Rob, no one could remember his last name. That meant that detectives had to dig, literally dig. This was before computerized records. There was no quick digital search that could be done. Investigators combed through boxes and boxes of paperwork, manually searching loan applications to try and identify him. And while they were doing that, police received a tip that sent a chill through the investigation. The call came from a local psychic. And this psychic claimed that they had a vision of Lisa walking down the street when a Corvette pulled up beside her. According to the caller, the driver offered Lisa a ride and she accepted. This was a startling coincidence, or was it? Investigators already knew about Rob and they knew about the Corvette, and now this call seemed like a promising lead. Now, obviously, not everyone believes in psychics, and of course, police don't usually automatically accept these calls as fact. But they do follow up, and in some cases, psychics have provided information that led to critical breakthroughs. So this tip really stood out. And the urgency to identify this Rob individual intensified even further when detectives learned something else. On Christmas morning, the phone rang at Diane's house. The caller identified himself as Rob and asked to speak with Lisa's mother. When Lisa's sister answered and said Diane wasn't available, the man left a brief message. He said, "Tell her I said Merry Christmas," and then hung up. According to Diane, she didn't know Rob from Lisa's work and had never heard that name before. And for her, learning about that phone call didn't feel innocent. It felt like a taunt. Finding Rob quickly became the most urgent priority. While investigators worked leads, Lisa's family remained inside the small apartment she shared with her husband. Every morning they woke up early and searched until late into the night. When exhaustion finally forced them to stop, they gathered back at the apartment, sleeping on couches and on the floor, staying close in case news came in about Lisa. No one wanted to leave. And Matthew remained optimistic. He said that he had no doubt that Lisa would be found alive, that she would be back in his arms, and he clung to that belief and encouraged everyone else to hold on to it too. Whenever reporters showed up, Matthew didn't shy away. He stepped in front of the cameras willingly, speaking about his wife, repeating the same message over and over, that he would never give up hope. He told the media he knew Lisa was alive and that he was going to find her. And he issued a plea to whoever had her. He begged, "Please keep her warm, keep her fed, bring her home." And he promised that no harm would come to them if they did. Matthew's interviews, his desperation, his emotion really pulled at the heartstrings of the people in the community. This small town rallied around him, offering support, joining the search day after day, trying to ease the pain of Lisa's absence in any way that they could. As time passed, the search stretched far beyond the neighborhood Lisa and Matthew called home. Volunteers began combing through rougher areas of Huntington, near abandoned buildings, warehouses, construction sites, farming fields, and places known for criminal activity. Matthew believed that if someone had taken Lisa and they were holding her hostage, these were the kinds of places they might hide her. But he also was worried about everyone's safety. He insisted that he and Lisa's family needed to protect themselves while searching these dangerous areas. And so Matthew went to a local gun store and purchased a shotgun, keeping it in the trunk of his car just in case. And finally, days into the search, investigators made a breakthrough. After combing through countless bank records, police located Rob's loan application. The paperwork provided them with his home address and place of employment, and detectives reached out and asked him to come in for questioning. When Rob was asked why he hadn't contacted police after hearing Lisa was missing, he gave an explanation. He said that he heard that Alisa Solomon was missing, but he didn't know anyone by that name. He only knew Lisa as Lisa Weaver, her maiden name. According to Rob, he simply didn't connect the dots that the missing woman was the same Lisa from the bank. Rob also confirmed that he had, in fact, called the Weaver residence on Christmas Day, explaining that he only meant to wish Diane a Merry Christmas. And that is still very strange to me. If Diane says she didn't know him, why was he calling? And I never really got the answer on that, but I do think that is kind of weird. But Rob said that he had no idea at the time that he placed that call that Lisa was missing. When investigators asked him where he had been on Christmas Eve night and Christmas Day, Rob told them that he had been in Connecticut spending the holiday with his family. After his alibi was confirmed, Rob was officially ruled out as being involved in Lisa's disappearance. And again, the whole phone call thing is just kind of odd to me, but whatever, he was cleared. And just like that, investigators were back to square one. For Lisa's family, time seemed to freeze. The Christmas tree still stood in the corner, lights glowing softly, unopened presents waiting beneath it. The approaching New Year felt impossible to face. Nothing felt right without Lisa. Her family rode a relentless emotional roller coaster. Anger, sadness, heartbreak, hope, and sometimes they went through all of those emotions in the same day. They clung to hope as long as they could. But as the days passed and 6 days slipped by with no answers, that hope began to feel heavier. The thought that they tried to push away, that Lisa might never come home, started to creep in, refusing to be ignored. Lisa's cousin, Stephen Clerk, later says he remembers feeling nothing but desperation, an overwhelming need to find his cousin. On the evening of December 30th, Stephen was searching fields on either side of an industrial road. The area was littered with debris. It was dark, it was snowy, and it was bitterly cold. Temperatures were hovering around 20 below. Still, Stephen pressed on. Around 11 p.m., he was walking the field with only a flashlight and a CB radio, staying in contact with others who were searching nearby. Everyone had been instructed to radio in at 11 to report their findings. Stephen called in to say that he hadn't found anything yet, but he noticed another field just across the road. He told them that he was going to stay out a little longer and search that area too, so it could be fully checked off the list. That field was scattered with large garbage bags filled with leaves and debris. It appeared that a cleanup crew had been through recently, bagging everything up, but the bags had yet to be hauled away. As Stephen walked, he kicked at the bags absentmindedly while talking back and forth over the CB to his father. Most of the bags were soft, light, and easy to move. Then he came across one that wasn't. It was hard and it was heavy. Stephen knelt down and began tearing into the bag. First, he saw an elbow, then an arm. In a state of shock and panic, he ripped the bag open further, and then he saw Lisa's face. Stephen Clerk had found his cousin. For a moment, he just stood there, frozen. The girl he had grown up with, the cousin he shared weekly family dinners with for as long as he could remember, was lying there, naked, folded into a bag, discarded in a field, treated like something meant to be thrown away. After a few moments, Stephen grabbed the CB radio and called to his father. His voice broke as he told him that he found Lisa and that she was no longer alive. Police were called, and within minutes, detectives were on scene because they were nearby. Officers began preparing to secure the area, just starting to roll out the crime scene tape when Matthew arrived, pulling up with his father. He jumped out of the car completely frantic. He was yelling. He was screaming. He kept repeating over and over, "Where is Lisa? I need to find Lisa. I want to find Lisa." And then he took off running. Matthew ran across the field diagonally without hesitation, straight toward where Lisa's body was. Stephen reacted on instinct. The only thing going through his mind was that Matthew was about to contaminate the scene. He lunged forward, grabbing Matthew, and tackled him to the ground. As Stephen held him there, Matthew began hyperventilating and crying, repeating over and over that Lisa was dead. Matthew was so distraught that an ambulance was called. He was unable to calm himself. He kept collapsing to the ground, overcome with emotion. Once the forensic team finished processing the scene, Lisa's body was transported to the morgue where an autopsy would be performed. Stephen, meanwhile, was taken to the police station and interviewed for several hours, giving a formal statement about what he had found. At the morgue, the autopsy had to be delayed. Because of the extreme cold, Lisa's body had been perfectly preserved, but that also meant it needed time to thaw before a thorough examination could be conducted. When the autopsy was finally completed a day or so later, the medical examiner determined that Lisa's cause of death was strangulation. Her hyoid bone, a small bone that is located in the throat, was fractured, an injury commonly associated with strangulation. The medical examiner concluded that Lisa likely died within 2 or 3 minutes. As the investigation continued, detectives closely examined the garbage bags and the ties used to secure them. They discovered red fibers and hairs on the bags recovered from the scene, and they were extremely interested in these fibers and wanted to know where they came from. Naturally, investigators began looking closely at everyone in Lisa's inner circle, and as is often the case, her husband was among the first examined. Matthew appeared devastated by the loss of his new bride. He had been deeply involved in the search, leading efforts, speaking to the media, and standing in front of news cameras, vowing he would never give up. He had turned the apartment into a makeshift base camp where volunteers returned for direction, updates, and comfort. Lisa's mother, Diane, spoke highly of Matthew during those days, both before Lisa was found and after. She believed he had done everything possible to find her daughter. At some point, she even said that while she had lost Lisa, at least she still had Matthew, someone that she loved dearly. But investigators would soon learn that not everyone in the family shared Diane's feelings.
Forget the pressure to overhaul your life. The new year doesn't need a new you. It needs you. Grounded, supported, and ready to grow. Grow Therapy helps you make meaningful change at your pace and on your time. Whether it's your first time in therapy or your 50th, Grow makes it easier to find a therapist who fits you, not the other way around. They connect you with thousands of independent, licensed therapists across the U.S., offering both virtual and in-person sessions, nights, and weekends. You can search by what matters, like insurance, specialty, identity, or availability to get started in as little as 2 days. And if something comes up, you can cancel up to 24 hours in advance at no cost. There are no subscriptions and no long-term commitments. You just pay per session. Grow helps you find therapy on your time. Whatever challenges you're facing, Grow Therapy is here to help. Grow accepts over 100 insurance plans, including Medicaid, in some states. Sessions average about $21 with insurance, and some pay as little as $0, depending on their plan. Visit growtherapy.com/get started today to get started. That's growtherapy.com/get started. growtherapy.com/get started. Availability and coverage vary by state and insurance plan.
New Year, same extra value meals at McDonald's. Now get a savory sausage McMuffin with egg, plus hash browns and a small coffee for just $5.
For a limited time only, prices and participation may vary. Prices may be higher in Hawaii, Alaska, and California and for delivery.
While investigators were speaking with members of Lisa's family, they learned that Lisa's uncle and cousins were not fans of Lisa's new husband, Matthew. Lisa's uncle, Howard Clark, recalled a time that his son, Eric, had been talking to Lisa and he put his arm around her. Mind you, this is Lisa's cousin. And Matthew walked up and threw Eric's arm off of Lisa and made threats to him about touching his girl. Lisa and Eric were like brother and sister. They grew up together, and Lisa was extremely close with her cousins. Even at her own wedding, Lisa was sitting on her uncle's lap, and they were laughing and chatting and carrying on. All the while, Matthew stood directly to the side, glaring at them. Her uncle Howard had even taken Lisa to the side at one point and tried to talk her out of the marriage. But she was so in love with Matthew that she didn't see any of what her uncle and cousins were pointing out. Stephen Clerk told the authorities that Matthew and Lisa had many ups and downs in their relationship. He described Matthew as controlling and possessive. Whenever Lisa and Matthew would go out to eat together or they would go shopping together, if Lisa had to use the restroom, Matthew would always escort her to the bathroom and then stand outside the door waiting for her. Stephen also said that before Lisa and Matthew got married and moved in together, Matthew would stop at Lisa's house most mornings before she went to work to check on her and to see what she was wearing for the day. And there were many times that he would object if he thought that what she was wearing would attract male attention. When asked if he thought Matthew was capable of murdering Lisa, Stephen didn't think so. He didn't think that Matthew was capable of murder, even if he was a little controlling and possessive. And as he sat there talking things through with detectives, Stephen had a light bulb moment. He remembered the moment that Matthew arrived at the scene where Lisa's body had been discovered. Stephen described that when authorities first arrived, they started putting out crime scene tape, but he had to correct them that they were on the wrong side of the road. Let me remind you that this industrial road had fields on either side of the road. Authorities were at the wrong field trying to put up their tape. It was before they crossed the road to put tape on the other side that Matthew pulled up. At the time when he pulled up, they had no officers standing in that field, no officers standing where Lisa was, no markers near the bags, no officers even standing on that side of the road at all. It was just an empty, dark stretch of land. But when Matthew rolled up and jumped out of the car, he immediately made a beeline directly to where Lisa's body was in the middle of this field. How could he have known where she was? Why would he pick that spot of all the spots to run to? And in that moment, as Stephen sat there with investigators recounting what happened the night Lisa was found, he knew. Matthew Solomon murdered Lisa. As the rest of the world rang in the new year, Lisa's family was doing something very different. They were planning her wake and funeral. At the wake, Lisa's casket was open. Family members gathered to say goodbye. When Matthew entered the room, he took one look at her and then turned and ran out of the building. He crossed the street, purchased a case of beer, returned to the funeral home, and went into the basement where friends gathered and he drank. At the funeral itself, Matthew didn't stand at the entrance greeting mourners as families often do. Instead, he stayed back in the shadows drinking heavily. Everyone grieves different, obviously. Loss looks different for everyone. But to Lisa's family, friends, and even the investigators, Matthew's behavior stood out. Stephen Clerk continued pressing investigators, insisting they needed to take a closer look at Matthew, and eventually they did. During the search for Lisa, Stephen's brother Gerald had been staying at the Solomon apartment around the clock. When investigators asked Gerald if he had noticed anything unusual about Matthew, one detail immediately stood out. Gerald recalled seeing Matthew step out of the shower one day, and he noticed a bite mark on his upper arm. It was a significant bite, and it was badly bruised. Gerald explained that he was likely the only person who had seen it because during the search, Matthew consistently wore long-sleeve shirts. When asked if anything else struck him as odd, Gerald mentioned Matthew's car trunk. He said he had personally watched Matthew place that shotgun he'd purchased into the trunk, And what surprised him was how clean it was. Abnormally clean, sterile even. This stood out because Matthew worked with tools and equipment, and the trunk looked nothing like you would expect from someone in that line of work. But there was one more detail. Gerald told investigators the trunk was lined with red carpeting. And investigators already knew that red fibers had been recovered from the garbage bags Lisa's body had been placed in. Around the same time, detectives spoke with the couple's landlord, who lived in the main part of the house beneath the upstairs apartment Lisa and Matthew rented. The landlord said that they had been home on Christmas Eve, and they remembered hearing Lisa and Matthew arguing upstairs. They described Matthew as being the one doing most of the yelling. That detail matched Matthew's own account. He had never denied that they argued that night, but the landlords added something else. They said that they heard what sounded like someone running across the floor above them. When investigators asked if they heard anyone go down the stairs or open the front door, the answer was no. What they did hear was a loud thud and then silence. As all of this information came together, Matthew remained cooperative. He continued answering questions and offering help, seemingly unaware that investigators were quietly zeroing in on him as their primary suspect. At one point, Matthew told police that he planned to leave town for a short time to clear his head. Before he left, he voluntarily handed over his keys to his car and apartment, giving investigators full permission to search both while he was gone. Matthew, in his mind, believed that he was helping, but in reality, the focus of the investigation had already shifted, and it was narrowing in fast. Inside the apartment, investigators found no obvious signs that a violent struggle had taken place. But when they opened the trunk of Matthew's car, they immediately saw what Gerald had described, the red carpeting lining the inside. Police collected samples from the carpet and sent them to the lab, where they were compared to the red fibers recovered from the garbage bag containing Lisa's body. And it was a perfect match. Not only that, but investigators were also able to recover video surveillance footage from a 7-Eleven of Matthew Solomon purchasing garbage bags that matched the garbage bags that Lisa was found in. With all of this information, police obtained an arrest warrant for Matthew Solomon. By then, Matthew had returned to New York from his brief trip away. In the early morning hours of January 11th, 1988, sometime around 6 a.m., as he was driving to work, police pulled him over and they arrested him. While in custody, Matthew's story changed. He now claimed that on Christmas Eve, he had fallen asleep and Lisa became upset, starting an argument. He said that they both had been drinking and the situation escalated quickly. When Lisa tried to leave the apartment, he said that he grabbed her as she screamed and yelled. Matthew claimed that he just put his arm around her, telling her to calm down, and that he only wanted her to relax so they could talk things through. And then, according to him, the next thing he knew, Lisa was dead. Matthew admitted that afterward, he undressed Lisa, placed her body into a garbage bag, and carried her to the car and drove about a mile away to dump her in that field. But he insisted that it was an accident. Investigators and Lisa's family didn't believe that for one second. If it had truly been an accident, Matthew could have called 911. He could have asked for help. Instead, he stripped his wife of just 2 months, an apparent attempt to stage the scene as a sexually motivated crime, and then transported her body and discarded her like garbage. After that, he got in front of the cameras begging and pleading for her safe return, and he vowed that he would never give up searching. He even told news reporters that he just knew that Lisa had to be alive and that he was going to find her, all the while knowing that she was already dead. Investigators determined that Matthew had placed Lisa in an armbar chokehold, holding it long enough for her to die. a process that took minutes, not seconds. Authorities and Lisa's family believe that the truth was far simpler and far darker. They believe that Matthew became enraged that Lisa planned to attend midnight mass with her mother. This was supposed to be their night, a Christmas celebration and their 2-month wedding anniversary combined. And when Lisa made plans outside of him, the controlling and overbearing Matthew Solomon became livid. In February of 1989, Matthew Solomon went to trial. The jury didn't deliberate long before finding him guilty of second-degree murder. The maximum sentence he could have received was 25 years to life. Instead, for reasons never fully explained, the judge sentenced him to 18 years to life. In 2019, after serving 31 years in prison and after 7 times being denied parole, Matthew Solomon was released. Despite the relentless efforts from Lisa's family to keep him behind bars, he was released. Her cousin, Stephen Clerk, summed it up best. Matthew deserved to remain behind bars for the rest of his life. Soft on crime is hard on victims, and I agree. Justice was not served, and Matthew should have never been released. Lisa's mother, Diane, took the news of his release extremely hard and said that she believes he is a dangerous person because he's such a great manipulator. According to publicly reported parole conditions, Matthew is required to live in upstate Broome County, where he can be closely supervised for the rest of his life. He must attend anti-aggression and domestic violence counseling, abstain from alcohol, provide his parole officer with contact information of anyone he enters into a relationship, and either maintain employment or continue his education. Lisa Solomon was just 22 years old when her life was cut short. She had so much life left to live. For Lisa's family, Christmas was never the same. A time that is meant to be joyful and happy is forever marked by tragedy. Crimesters, that is all that I have for this week's episode. Thank you so much for listening to Lisa's tragic story. If you're not a part of my private Facebook group, you can find it by searching Crime with Holly Podcast Discussion Group. In there, I share all information and pictures pertaining to the cases that I cover, and I also encourage all members to share all things true crime. You can find me over on Instagram at CrimeaHolly, and if you would like more true crime content, you can find me at TikTok at crimewithholly.podcast. Happy New Year, everyone, and I cannot wait to spend my 2026 with you guys. Always remember to be aware and take care. Bye-bye.
Your check, your cooperative. As a farmer-owned lender, Farm Credit Mid-America shares the success of the cooperative with our customers, which is why we've returned more than $1.5 billion back to our customer owners over the last 9 years. It's proof being a part of our cooperative pays. Patronage is an annual decision made by the board of directors to return earnings to eligible customers. To learn more about patronage and eligibility, visit fcma.com/patronage.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to get stronger just around the corner, so you can give everything you've got. Whether you want to crush a few reps before class with our expanded strength equipment or sweat it out on your way home from work, with over 2,800 locations, there's a Planet Fitness close to you, and most are open 24 hours. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends January 30th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Hi, everybody. It's Andy and James here from your next favorite podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
That's right. We do fun facts.
Yes, we do. James, give me a fact.
Did you know that there is an extinct bandicoot whose official scientific name is Crash Bandicoot?
Lovely. I didn't know that. Did you know, James, that Upper Egypt is technically below Lower Egypt?
Incredible. Absolutely amazing. I would love to hear more about that.
Well, all you have to do is go and listen to No Such Thing as a Fish.
Where will I find it?
Oh, like, all over.
Okay, bye.
Bye.